tonight on Arena. Brendan Fraser discusses his role in Rental Family, Dave Rudden on Sister Wake, and Eureka Day comes to the Gate Theatre. You can text us on 51551. The WhatsApp is open as well at 0870 32 32 32. Email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte underscore arena. You think I'd have it right at this stage. Tonight, to start the programme, Brendan Fraser is a true legend of 90s cinema, bringing his swashbuckling charm to films like The Mummy, George of the Jungle and California Man. More recently, he made a remarkable comeback, winning an Oscar for his work on Darren Aronofsky's The Whale, and then following it up with a pivotal role in Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. Now, Brendan Fraser stars in Rental Family, a gentle Japanese film about isolation and connection, set against the backdrop of modern Tokyo. The film tells the story of Philip, an out-of-work American actor who finds unexpected purpose with a Japanese agency that rents out fake family members to lonely clients. Rental Family is written and directed by Hikari, acclaimed for her previous work on the Netflix series Beef and the film 37 Seconds. Recently, I met them both in Dublin to talk about the film, but before I bring you that conversation, let's get a sense of the film. In this scene, Brendan Fraser as Philip meets Shinji, played by Shogun's Takahiro Hira, who runs the agency and who has to explain exactly what it is that they do.
So, what do you think we do?
You, if I have to guess, you sell people.
No.
No. We sell emotion.
Oh, how?
We play roles in the client's lives.
Oh, thanks. But you can't just, you know, replace someone in your life.
Yes and no. But people are willing to take a leap. The actor, the surrogate. You don't have to be that person. You just have to help clients connect to what's missing.
Like what?
Well, could be anybody from their life or feeling they once had. Parents, siblings, boyfriends, girlfriends, best friends. We played it all.
Well, they could just get a therapist.
It's not that easy here. Mental health issues are stigmatized in this country. So, people have to turn to other things, like us.
Well, what do you need me for?
We need a talking white guy. It's a niche market, and I need someone to fill the role.
Just talking white guys. I'm just an actor. I don't know how to help people.
But you know how to perform. Have you seen the resume? Look, what I'm offering here is a chance to play roles with a real meaning.
Brendan Fraser and Hikari, you're both very welcome to Arena. Hikari, I might start by asking you about the film and about where the story of Rental Family comes from. Tell me a little bit about that.
So my writing partner, Stephen Blayhead, was looking for a random job to do, for an American person to do, in Japan. And there's a butler cafe dressing up like a butler person and, you know, serving tea to all this, you know, quirky stuff, to professional, like teaching English, translation, all of it. And the rental family business popped up. And he asked me, do you know anything about this? And I'm Japanese. I was born and raised in Japan. I was like, what is rental family? So that was kind of beginning of it. We start looking for, again, why this business exists, what kind of people use, you know, all of it, what kind of people give services. It was more like a background of a society, right? Like, why? And, and then from there, we just kind of start going through researches and interviewing a lot of people who actually provide the services. And that's where kind of our inspiration all came from. And, yeah.
And Brendan, I suppose the same question for you in terms of this. You're coming at this presumably not knowing anything about these agencies, about where they come from. So when you're given the script for this for the first time, what was your reaction?
Well, I wanted to know what a rental family is. It's all there in the title, I guess, is the answer. But, you know, does it mean family for sale? And so I met with Hikari so that we could find out. I could find out. And she let me know. I mean, among many things, we had about a 5 or 6 hour conversation. But she let me know that there's a population in Japan who are out of sight very often, and that's because they are affected by loneliness. And the reality of that might be surprising, considering it being such a populated and busy place, that seclusion like that can really exist at epidemic proportions. And it's the truth. It can happen. The film is a love letter to loneliness, but it's addressed to Tokyo, but it could be anywhere in the world. And culturally, there are, as was explained to me, there are stigma attached to mental health issues. So what are you to do if you feel this way and you can't express or treat it or find a way to fulfill this need with therapy, for instance? Knowingly or not, the workaround is hiring people, in this instance, as rental family members, with the understanding that it is make-believe, it is a service for hire. All parties concerned typically should know what the rules are. But what happens to those folks when they go home at the end of the day, both the providers and the clients? What happens when genuine feelings are established or felt, knowing that ethically this is all pretend? Well, that's what she wanted to explore, and that's what made the most sense about the story that this script takes us on.
Philip, what's going on?
Nothing, just I need a moment.
How long's a moment?
A moment.
We need you downstairs, now.
Michael, listen, I'm sorry, I can't go through with this.
Listen, all you have to do is sip sake, that's it.
Well, it's a lie. I'm messing with people's lives.
Hey.
What are you doing?
This is not a lie. It's an opportunity. The parents get the memory they want. The bride gets her freedom. If you don't go through with this, you will ruin her life. Do you understand? Get out!
I'm interested in that it is rare enough that an English language speaking actor gets the opportunity to act in a film like this, where you are surrounded by actors speaking a different language and where you yourself speak Japanese in sections of the film. I mean, that's presumably radically different than anything you've ever done before.
Agreed. And don't be too impressed with my Japanese, because Akira Yamamoto-san learned to speak far more English to play this part than I learned to speak Japanese. But once we connected, as actors should do, and stop saying the words, you know, phonetically, maybe with the wrong syllable, and just spoke the thoughts and had the feelings about what we were saying, then it all fell into place.
Hikari, as a director, why have an American star in what is, I mean, otherwise an entirely Japanese film?
Well, a lot of stories that I write, I like to write or focus on, is somewhat come from my own personal experience, life experience. And when I first came to America, I was an exchange student, and I lived in this area, I lived in a state called Utah, where not very many, you know, Asian people lived at the time. And I was being the only person in the room. And while I felt a bit lonely, or, you know, obviously isolation, because I didn't speak the language, there's so many wonderful people that I met during that experience, during that exchange student program. And those people are still to this day my favorite people, and we become family, right? And so for me, that whole experience of found family, what is it to be the only person, but yet you find this connection, human connection, I wanted to see what it like to... What if we put this gentleman, who is from Minnesota, little tiny town, to live in a big city like Tokyo, and that relationship that he may possibly create. So I wanted to explore that, what is that like to be. But then also, this loneliness we talk about, it just happening around the world at this point, you know, like, I feel like we are in the place where a lot of countries, cities, people, just there's so many, you know, there's so many people who feel like it's divided. And I felt like I wanted to write a story about a kind of approach that issue of how can we connect, you know, one another. When we were also writing the story, it was during the pandemic. And, you know, during the pandemic, we just didn't know where we were going. And it was just like suddenly there's isolation, right? Loneliness, you remember that. And for me, it was like, how can I make sure that let people know that there are a way to come people together and make people feel okay, even though you feel isolated. There's a community that you potentially, you know, bring together. That was kind of like the thoughts behind writing the story.
Brendan, I wanted to ask you about Japan. Did you have any experience of Japan before you went there to make this film? I mean, if you didn't, did it live up to your expectations?
Far exceeded them. Over the previous years, I had been trapped in hotel rooms across Tokyo, speaking to journalists, but occasionally I would sneak out and have a look around. I was absolutely all at once overwhelmed, charmed, made to feel welcome. I found myself feeling a bit lost, then found again. It was somewhere that truly made me feel like all at once the most welcome outsider I could have been for how much I stand apart in a crowd, for instance, but I still felt very lonely. And if or not I applied any of this to making this film, it certainly influenced how I felt about approaching this character. I felt like I needed to work somewhere new, in a new way, with the Japanese crew. It's a Japanese film with English language subtitles. I would have liked to have done a lot more Japanese if I was allowed to, but, you know, as was explained to me by the studio, the working language of the world is English, so let's tell the story for that broad, broad, broad audience. And that's all right, because, you know, like I said, it doesn't matter what you're saying necessarily, what the words are. It's how you're saying and what you mean. So communicating was never a problem, really, for me. And knowing that we all kind of want the same things at the end of the day, I was just able to apply all that to playing this part.
So, Brendan, it almost feels as if you're in a new phase of your career at this stage. I mean, people will know you from the late 90s, early 00s, from everything from the Mummy series to Blast from the Past, which I particularly liked, George of the Jungle and Bedazzled. You've always done serious dramatic roles, but ones like Philip here or your role in The Whale or in Killers of the Flower Moon, does this feel like a new phase of your career?
Well, isn't it always? I mean, insofar as what's next is new, and I guess there's a conceit that now I have the pick of the litter. It's just not true. Considering what's being made now in the industry, that factors into the decisions that you make. If anything, it makes me feel like I need to be even more judicious. And what worked for me previously, in all those titles you just named, was a tactic I always employed privately to try and do something that was different from whatever it was that I had done previously, so that hopefully I would keep myself interested in what I'm doing enough to not bore an audience, and also to diversify the choices, because I wanted to be able to keep learning as I go along. And Rental Family was an opportunity to continue in that spirit.
I'm particularly interested in that Philip isn't necessarily a great actor in this film, is he? But we see him resting in the role of a tree at one point. But he is really great in the roles that the agency asks him to do.
Yeah, I guess you could say he's quite a wooden actor. Waka, waka. Philip stops acting and engaging and being authentic with the people who he meets, because he sees in them real need. The artifice of acting is gone. The clients he works for are the genuine thing. And what he gets out of it is far more valuable to him than whatever he's being paid. But the quandary is, what happens when people have feelings that are genuine as a result of that type of temporal imaginary relationship. And that's what the film seeks, to have a real hard look at. All the moral and ethical questions ensue, and that's where Hikari's directed a film that lets make believe about reality and have us see that there is a way that we can connect with one another in a meaningful way without having to pretend.
I do think we should mention 11-year-old Shannon Mahina-Gorman, who plays Mia in the film. She's absolutely fantastic in it. Philip is hired to play the role of her father. She is extraordinary as an actor, isn't she?
Absolutely right. I mean, 9 years old, had not acted before. She listens, as an actor does, only after many years of wondering if they're going to have a career that sustains. She knows this inherently already. It's all of, you know, all the nice things I could say about it come down to its talent, and you don't know what talent is until you see it. You can't put your finger on it, but you acknowledge it right away. She's no exception. She's got a Japanese mom, dad's Irish, and she speaks her English with an Irish accent.
That's right.
Look, hey, who cannot see this little girl and have their heart grow 3 sizes? And that's the exact same thing that happens with Philip. And I'll attest that I'm fond of her personally too.
Brendan Fraser and Hikari, thank you so much for joining us on Arena.
Thank you so much for having us.
Absolute pleasure.
You knew the situation. You knew we were her last option, and you still nearly backed out.
But I didn't.
But you would have. See, you're just a gaijin. You will never understand how things work here.
You're right, I am gaijin, but Japan is my home now. And I want to try to understand. Why do you do this?
What?
This job. You're so passionate about it. Why?
It's the way these people look at you. Like they've been waiting for you their whole lives. Despite everything Tada says, these people stay with you. Sometimes all we need is someone to look us in the eye and remind us we exist.
And that was Brendan Fraser and Mari Yamamoto in a scene from Rental Family. The film opens this weekend and we'll be reviewing it on Friday night's Arena. And you're very welcome back to Tuesday night's Arena. Jonathan Spector's play Eureka Day has been described as one of the most entertaining pieces of theatre of the past decade. Winner of Best Revival of a Play at last year's Tony Awards, this highly topical work transports us to the hills of Berkeley, California, and to Eureka Day, an independent alternative school where liberal values and inclusion reign supreme. That is, until a health scare shakes the parents and community to its core. At the end of the month, the play will have its Irish premiere at the Gate Theatre in Dublin. I'm delighted that director Roy Alexander Wise and Stephen Brennan, who plays Don, are both here this evening. You're both very welcome to Arena.
Nice to be here.
Good evening.
Roy, I want to start with you. Eureka Day premiered in the UK at the Old Vic in London a little over 3 years ago. It toured across the UK. It's been on Broadway. When you had the opportunity to bring this play to Ireland for the first time, what was it about the work and what was it about the setting that made you think that this could be for me?
I do a lot of American plays. It's very strange. I do a lot of American plays. And so there's, I don't know, there is something about Americans that I kind of really love and I'm a bit obsessed. But I think with this play in particular, you know, everything that I do has to have like a bit of humor in it. I think it's one of the main ingredients, I think, of like going to the theatre or having an experience. But I think it was like the play's endeavour to sort of like wrangle with the idea of like how we have conversations. I think there's been so much, we've been like told so much about how we're supposed to be now and how you're supposed to behave and how you're supposed to speak. And now it's like, well, let's see what all of that instruction looks like in reality. And Jonathan has written this play that's almost like sheet music, I think, for the actors, where you You know, I mean, even if I gave you a page to read, which maybe we should do, actually, you'd like, you can see the way in which, like, the hesitance that sort of emerges when we're all sort of guarded about the way that we're supposed to be behaving and the way that we're supposed to be communicating. And part of it is, like, incredibly natural, and some of it is really unnatural. And I think there's something about that collision of, like, the ambition and the hope of, like, a really inclusive society, but then, like, the drive and how you actually make people change, like, seeing those things come together in this story that is literally just about an executive board of people figuring out how to like navigate a mumps scare in a daycare setting is kind of genius. So I think it was the story. It feels like really like a microcosm of a world that feels so far away, but it feels really epic and like incredibly universal too. Like everybody can relate to the story of like a parent and a child and a parent wanting to do the best thing for their child, but like marrying that with like another responsibility for a community, then there's a really, really interesting bit of drama that I think happens. So yeah, that was what drew me to it.
I have a question that maybe works for both of you, and I will start with you, Roy. That, I've read the play script, and it reads as if it is something that is being constantly interrupted by itself, whereby it's an incredibly hard thing to read on a cold page. I imagine much harder to do as an actor, and I will ask you about that, Stephen. What's that like to try and direct something that certainly in the early parts is like incredibly fragmented?
For me, I'm a real stickler for clarity. Like, before I think about it being funny or entertaining, I mean, and I know it will be because I'm making it, but also because I've got really brilliant, funny artists in the room making it with me. But I think clarity is the first thing that I try to do. So, like, we spend a lot of time working out, like, what are the thoughts that the characters are having behind the text? Like, what are they doing to each other with the lines? What are they actually saying? Because, you know, sometimes you're like reading along and you get a bit lost and go like, wait, hang on, what is the argument that is being had right now? But I think like just really carefully tracing it through and understanding beat by beat, what is the exchange that's actually happening between these people? We start there and then we sort of like build it up. There's a lot of repetition in the room. We're like, okay, great, let's do that page again. Let's do that page again. Let's do that page again. And breaking it up so that it into bite-sized chunks, because it's like a real... reading it on the page feels very heady, but actually like the experience once like you put the energy and the speed behind it and everyone's really comfortable and playing in the room, actually it just reads like a bunch of people having a conversation. But like, because on the page it's like sure and of course, you know, the way it's sort of like written as naturally as we speak is really challenging to actually put together.
I mean, you're the one that's actually going to have to play one of the ensemble parts, Stephen. What was that like when you saw the script for the first time? What did you make of it?
I cried. I went to see my analyst, and I'll be going to see him again very soon. It's challenging. I love a challenge, and when I've been through some pretty challenging roles in my time, but when you're reading a script that not only are you interrupted by other people, but you interrupt yourself, sometimes it's kind of hard to keep track of what you're talking about. And I'm not great at knowing what I'm talking about at the best of times, but...
that is not true.
we're unpicking all of that, and hopefully by the time we've arrived on the stage with this, it will seem very natural, very seamless, but it's not naturalistic in the sense that it's a slice of real life. If I want that, I go to the pub. This is a theatre and it's a play, so it will be 10 inches off the ground for everybody, but hopefully it will flow in a most naturalistic way and you won't know for a moment that everybody's absolutely terrified.
The play was premiered in 2018 initially in California, so before the pandemic, but it captures that huge uproar and that furious debate you can have around the principle of vaccination. So maybe just explain to us the story here when we find ourselves at the beginning of the play.
Well, they've discovered that there is a student in the school that has been reported as having mumps. So the health authority in Berkeley, where the play is set, says that the school has to quarantine everyone. So until you've been vaccinated or have had the mumps for a sufficient period of time, you can't come back to the school. So that has all sorts of ramifications for Don as the head of the school, because, you know, unfortunately, at the end of the day, that's about money. Mm. They're a very liberal, very open, you know, kind of ethos in the school, but they still need money to run it. And it's run on the tuition that the people pay for. And if you're not giving them that, they suddenly they're looking for the money back. So a problem arises straight away. And it's hard for him to kind of equate what's best to do and what's best not to do. And, you know, it is set in the land of the conspiracy theorists and the vaxxers and anti-vaxxers and all the fake news and all that. So you get all that debate spills out. The great thing, of course, is that it's not a COVID play. It was written in 2018, so it's before that. But it does throw up a lot of these issues that came up during COVID.
Is there something, Roy, about that, about the idea of a play that did quite well initially, it did okay and has done well since then, and now is coming around to a point in time whereby it may be finding an audience that's much more receptive to it than it did initially?
I think so. I mean, no shade to the production that happened in London, but I didn't see it. It had, like, brilliant actors in it. Like, we were all shipped over from the States. It was at the Old Vic. But I think something about the subject matter, watching it, like, I think it was, like, circa 2021, 22, it just felt like... And I was running a theatre at the time, and every programming meeting that we had, I was like, we are not doing any plays whatsoever that are going to talk about COVID. Like, we can't do that. The one thing that I think we all want to do is try and rediscover what it is to have been a human being before all of that, you know, and try and remember what that experience was like and conjure that again. But I do think that now we're in this world where, like, oh, the money doesn't make as much sense as it used to before. What was that? Oh, yeah, COVID. And I think that we're sort of in a place where, as a society, we are ready to sort of unpack that. It was half a decade ago, actually, and it feels wild to say that, but it was half a decade ago. We're definitely living in the ramifications of that now, but yeah, it feels like there's like a bit of distance and a bit of space for us to crack that open, to laugh about it a little bit, because, you know, it was a really tense and challenging time. But also, like, you know, there's a lot of heart in the play that allows us to actually wrangle with some of the more challenging aspects of that period of time as well. So there is something about that feels really important and exciting for me. That, I think, is going to be like the main sort of reference point that a lot of people will have when they come and see the play.
Talk to me a little bit about the casting of the play itself, because it's important to get all of these characters right on stage. You have a lot of actors who've been cast with varying levels of experience. Some will be familiar faces from TV or from the stage. How did that process work?
It was a wonderful process, actually. I worked with a brilliant casting director called Helena Palmer, who I've worked with in the past as well. I sort of had a bit of a charge from the theatre. There was like, yeah, we need to get a bit of, you know, weight in the cast as well. And also, like, the ambition for it to be an international cast as well, that there was a possibility for me to bring artists from the UK to come and work at the gate as well, which felt really exciting. It was kind of magical in that, like, I don't feel like I had to search very long to find these people. I think a play like this, where you're casting five very distinct characters, and actors needing to have a very particular kind of, like, skill to be able to pull off the style of performance. Like, there's the ability to, like, play incredibly naturally, but, like, know exactly the joke that is being played for the audience as well. And every single one of them, like, did that. Like, we met on a Zoom, Stephen and I,
And yes, somebody in the gate found my phone number down the back of the drawer, I think, and gave it to Roy.
I was going to ask you about that because I've read today, this can't be right, that it's been 12 years since you were last
coming
on stage
home.
At the gate.
Coming home.
He's coming.
So, sorry, what is that like to be back and in this particular play?
Well, it's lovely to be back in the gate. It's lovely to be back anywhere, really, I suppose, at my age. I'm actually far too old for this part. He didn't mention that this man is in his early 60s and I've just had a roundy birthday. So, but my task is, of course, to make you believe that wonderful actor on the stage is only 62. And I will do that.
He is doing that. He is doing that. But yeah, it was a wonderful process, I think. Like, I really loved it. And the group of people that we have in the room is... It's magical.
All the best shows happen when you walk into a room and you know you're going to get on with everybody. It just happens. It's a kind of electricity that happens. And it's down to the director to cast a show properly because you never recover from bad casting.
That is so true.
We don't talk about that. But anyway, this is just one of those lovely groups of people that you know they're going to produce something wonderful.
That is sometimes one of those intangible things, isn't it, Stephen? The idea that particularly when you've got only four, five, six people in a play, that if you can get on with those people and if you understand that you're going to be okay with them over the course of the run of that, that's not quite half the work, but it's a lot of the work.
It's important, and it I think it comes across if everyone's working well together, everyone's pulling in the same direction. And this is the first show I've done for as long as I can remember, where I walked into a rehearsal room where I didn't know anybody. I didn't know any of the cast. I'd never worked with them before. I hadn't worked with Roy before. And that's a great thing. I consider that a movement forward for me as an actor, that I'm working with new people. And all the people I used to work with are probably tired of me now anyway, so I'm delighted to be moving on. But it's a good room that I think feeds into the production.
I'd read, Roy, if I have this right, that a run of the play was cancelled at the Kennedy Centre in Washington after a shake-up of the board that people will know about by the current US president. It's been said that it was for financial reasons, but there are obviously suspicions that it was more than that.
I'm suddenly very aware that I'm on the radio. I do want to go back to America at some point. I don't know exactly what it was, but I think as a play, it definitely is approaching conversations around some of those buzzwords like wokeness and identity politics and things that I think make some people feel incredibly uncomfortable and maybe fear exclusion and make some people feel like, oh my God, thank God, like the gates are opening and we're being allowed a glance at the great city. And so there's a part of me that suspects that there is maybe a bit of that challenges, I think, some people, audiences, but I think actually the great power of the play is in that there is no one bias that is represented as the answer. You know, all of these five characters represent completely different viewpoints, and all of these characters surprise you in very, very interesting ways too, in terms of the things that they believe and the things that they champion in the way that they behave in the play, I think. So, I mean, I can see how on the surface, without knowing the material, it might be like, what is this? But actually, it really is a play about communities. Well, it's a play about like the individual versus the community and where is your responsibility first. And I think that we feel like we've all got that answer unlocked for ourselves. And actually, I think the play will either make that answer really simple or far more complicated for you when you come along. And that's really exciting. You know, we need to talk about how we talk about those things that are really hard. And I think the play is a brilliant opportunity to like witness what it is to see discourse happening, to see people really trying their best, and to see their own individual biases, traumas, experiences, either like pushing that along or getting in the way. And that's incredibly human. It's a chance for us to see how we might fit into those puzzles too.
Can I say that it's a fantastic answer to an awkward question?
I'm glad you didn't ask me.
Theatre director Roy Alexander Wise and actor Stephen Brennan, thanks for joining us this evening on Arena. Eureka Day by Jonathan Spector will open at the Gate Theatre in Dublin on the 4th of February. There are previews from the 30th of January to the 3rd of February, and the production runs until the 8th of March, and you'll find more at gatetheatre.ie. Author Dave Rudden received the Best Senior Children's Book Prize at the 2017 Irish Book Awards for his debut novel, Knights of the Borrowed Dark. He's since completed the trilogy with The Forever Court and The Endless King. He's also written Doctor Who story collections for the BBC and last year brought out his debut book for 9 to 11-year-olds, the award-nominated Con of the Dead. Sister Wake is his new novel, his first for adults and the first in a fantasy series reimagining Ireland's rebel history and its fight to be free of English colonialism. Dave Rudden joins me in studio. You're very welcome to Arena, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
Your pitch for the series is, and this is a quote, if you don't know Irish history, it's Andor meets Elden Ring. And if you know Irish history, it's Irish history meets Elden Ring. So we should probably begin with Elden Ring. What is it and why did it inspire this book in particular?
So Elden Ring is the most recent game from the visionary Japanese game director Hidetaka Miyazaki, who became famous in the West for his Dark Souls games, which are set in broken worlds where very little of the story is explained and you figure it all out through environmental storytelling, through remains on the ground. There's an entire cottage industry of people who make 9-hour long YouTube videos about what it could mean. And whenever you ask him directly, he just gives a Dr. Hibbert laugh and says, that's one interpretation. apparently, this sort of measure of storytelling came from growing up poor in Japan and having very little English and going into bookshops and reading as many books in English as he could before he was chased out by security. And because he didn't understand how the stories connected a lot of the time, he would make up his own interpretations. So he tells stories where you have to find your own through line. And one of the things that directly sort of inspired Sister Wake is that the games are famous for having these like colossal, terrifying, beautifully designed bosses, these huge creatures. And when they would bring designs to him of these like horrible monsters, he would say, no, they have to be sad. Monsters have to be sad. They're tragic beings. They don't want to be like this. And so part of introducing huge creatures into this Irish history retelling was this idea of an empire being something you can only see part of and you do not understand it. It does not explain itself to you and you have to try and figure it out or die.
The novel is set on the island of Cree, which was conquered by its neighbour, the Answering, hundreds of years previously. So Cree is a model for Ireland, and it's all about our history with our neighbours across the sea, isn't it?
It is indeed. There's a Goodreads review where they were like, well, I enjoyed the book, but it's just very obviously Ireland and England. It's like, yeah, it's on the back of the book. I'm not trying to hide. That's not a secret. I'm definitely like putting my cards on the table.
The heroine, Sister Wake, she's central to the latest rising to erupt on Cree. So who is she? Why is she so important to this cause? Like, where do we find ourselves at the beginning of the book?
So I was very lucky with this trilogy and my previous Knights of the Borrowed Dark trilogy because the first chapter sort of arrived all in one. I was pitching books to my agent and I wrote three first chapters and then I sat back down at my laptop and wrote the first chapter of Sister Wake all in one go, which is what I had done with Knights of the Borrowed Dark. And I immediately had this girl chained to an altar on a mountainside, about to be sacrificed for a better harvest, for a better year, and is obviously having something of a crisis of faith and starts asking herself, you know, why is she the price? Why do these things have to be bargained for? You know, if these gods are our gods, why does there have to be conditions of sale? And on that morning, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately for her, the gods do return and she becomes a saint. And even though she is now venerated, even though she is now on the other side of the altar, she never forgets what it's like to be the price rather than the person who benefits.
I saw you say something really interesting recently about how so much of what we would all think of as fantasy literature, it all originates, quite a lot of it does, in English history. And that was one of the things that spurred you to write Sister Wake and to look at it from an Irish angle.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it a lot of modern fantasy has its roots in Tolkien, and Tolkien was inspired by lots of different cultures, but there is, it's very British coded. You know, Helm's Deep is Cheddar Gorge, and near Glastonbury, Weathertop is Glastonbury Tor, and from that, you know, you go towards things like Dungeons and Dragons or the like Wheel of Time, these huge fantasy things that everything sort of draws from. It's all vaguely British. It's all tunics and it's ale. And people have kind of a, what Terry Pratchett called a white noise knowledge of medieval times, which is a hilarious term for like quite a long period of time. And for me, I'm always asking myself what I can bring to the table or to the genre that's original. And a friend of mine who is from the Deep South and is a beautiful writer, he grew up in like a hunting shack. You know, he was like in the depths of Alabama, and he never wrote about that until he got to college. And his lecturer said to him, why are you not writing about growing up in the South? Why are you not writing about the fact your stepfather broke your nose with an axe handle when you were 12? And he was like, well, it's just my life. And he's like, no, that's your heat. That's your thing. And so I try and challenge myself with every book that I write, is to write the sort of grand epic fantasy that I've loved my entire life, but to rethink and interrogate all of the moment-to-moment granular choices that I was making in terms of what people drank and in terms of what they ate, what they wore, and bringing a specific Irish element to it, because there are things in our history that are so amazing, like you couldn't make them up. Like the one that I always go back to is, if you were running like a hostelry, like a little pub in like 14th, 15th century Ireland, your shop measures were hen's eggshells, because cheap, you have loads of them, you're not going to have like a fancy iron like thing. It's beautiful. It's like if you were rich in Dublin in the 13th century, you might have been eating rice and almond milk. So there are things that you couldn't imagine your way into that are just ripe for the taking.
That sounds like it required a lot of research.
It did. And the approach that I use is that, because I love seeing my word count go up, I've kind of gamified writing in my head. And my first drafts are very much the broad brush stroke. I have what I call the sort of bedside table phrases. You know, it's fine if it's like they're drinking ale and they're wearing tunics. And then the second and third draft, I have like a stack of books beside my desk. I went to the National Folklore Collection. I interviewed different historians. And then you can sort of add in all that specificity that really makes it stand out.
The Answering is a culture that prides itself on logic and practicality. So how much fun was it unleashing the gods of Cree on the unsuspecting nobles?
It was extremely satisfying. That breaking point that I think a culture who describes and characterizes themselves as superior and knowing everything, and to have that snap. And it did take, you know, introducing huge gods to them to do that. But I think, you know, one of my characters in the book is from that culture. And when he travels to Cree, because of he has a sort of a naturalist fascination with these creatures, he is suddenly face to face with the people that his people have been oppressing, and is forced to ask questions that very comfortably he never had to ask. You know, you run into people all the time in London who are like, oh, like, you know, you guys are still sort of English, right? And it's like, it's 2026. No, we're not. But they've never had to think about it. And a lot of the characters in the book respond to that well, and a lot of the characters do not respond to that well.
You like world building. I mean, it's something you did in Knights of the Borrowed Dark, and it's something that you're going to be doing here in Sister Wake and the books that follow it as well. What's the greatest challenge in that?
The greatest challenge is being a quasi-expert in everything, but realizing as soon as you start to research that you are an expert in nothing, and then balancing the interesting things that you find with telling a story. So world building is often sort of lionized in fantasy, this idea of creating all these interlocking systems. And if you like look at any like forum or space online, it's people sharing these really elaborate systems they've worked on for years and they haven't written a page. It's all about the reader. It is all about the story. You show them what they need to know about the world, but you have to know much more than them, but you can't ever forget your audience.
In terms of that audience, there are people who are reticent to engage with books that are described as fantasy in one form or another. How do you kind of get through to those people when realistically you're telling an alternate history of our own country, just through a different lens.
It has been interesting. I have had people say, this is the first fantasy book I've ever read. I didn't know fantasy could be good. And I'm like, I will take that as the compliment that I think it was intended. For me, all fiction is fantasy. I mean, Hamlet is fantasy. Kafka is fantasy. Atwood is fantasy. Fantasy is just a tool that we use to tell a story. The human experience is built on shared fantasy. Terry Pratchett, my favourite author, said that we need fantasy to hang at the point where the falling angel meets the rising ape. Justice and mercy are fantasies that we share and we cling on to, and they're incredibly important. And so I think for people who are fantasy fans, there is a lot in it. There is powers, there are monsters. And then for the people who are interested in the history and the politics, there'll be a lot there for them as well. I think everyone should just read more fantasy.
Dave Rudden, it has been a joy talking to you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us on Arena. You can get Sister Wake in shops now. It is published by Hotterscape. Just before we leave you tonight, we have some sad news coming in tonight with the announcement of the death of one of the country's best known Irish traditional singers, Sean O'Shea. Sean was a contributor to many radio and television programmes over the years, including shows recorded with Donal Lunny, Dermot O'Brien and Pather O'Riordan. Sean was affectionately known as The Pucker, which was a play on the comic song An Puck Ar Bhuile, which he recorded in 1962. Ar Yeis de Gairbh a Thonaim. Tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. Ollie Hamilton was our production coordinator. Research by Paula Shields. Sound supervision was by James Feeney. I'll talk to you tomorrow night again at 7 o'clock, and we will leave you with a little of Sean O'Shea's An Puck Ar Bhuile. Hogan from the air will hello, the rehmer trust na tree logo the glossian cora perfect na munye is trasker da Tortoga, who's not knowing the ground left when you're hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.